Today's Teisho is on case 27 in the Mumon Khan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 27 is entitled Nonsense, Not Mind, Not Buddha, Not Things. A monk asked Nansen, "Is there any Dharma that has not been preached to the people?" Nansen said, "There is." "What is the truth that has not been taught?" asked the monk. Nansen said, "It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things." Mumon's comment. At this question, Nansen used up all his treasure and was not a little confused. Mumon's verse. "Talking too much spoils your virtue. Silence is truly unequaled. Let the mountains become the sea. I'll give you no comment." You know, the Zen view is that everything we require to wake up is present in the moment. And this is the basis of our practice. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, we have an ideal state in mind. We imagine that we'll sit down on the cushion and enter samadhi and mushin, like mind. And this sometimes happens. But very often that's not what happens. You know, you sit down on the cushion and your mind is very unruly. And it thinks about the movie you saw last night, or maybe there's some problem at work that you can't get free from. And maybe you're just anxious, you know, and you sit down on the cushion and you feel the anxiety sort of coming up in waves. Maybe you feel sadness. All of these things happen when we sit. You know, the idealization is that we're going to come in and sit down on the cushion. You straighten your back, you breathe from your hara, and basically you go through a series of steps that are supposed to lead to samadhi. And it's possible sometimes to be very frustrated by this process. I will get up at the end of the sitting period and walk around and talk to everybody. And I'll say, "How is your sit?" And, you know, some people have really had wonderful sits. And they'll say, "Oh, you know, it was great, you know." A few nights ago, as a matter of fact, I was talking to somebody who came to sit, and I said, "How was your sit?" And she said, "Oh, it was wonderful. I felt like my body disappeared, my hands were gone. All I could feel was just a little bit of my face, and I felt weightless, and I was in that state for a while, you know. Wonderful, that's fantastic, you know." I said, "That's samadhi." And another person came up to me, and I said, "How was your sit?" "Oh, great. How do you feel?" "Wonderful." You know. So, you know, from time to time, people have come up to me and they say, "Can I talk to you?" and they'll say, you know, I've never had that state, or I've never had that experience. You know, maybe there's something wrong with my practice. So it's possible to form an incorrect view of practice. It's possible to form an incorrect view of practice. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we want to be in deep samadhi. And this happens sometimes, you know. You sit down on the cushion, you're watching your breath, and you begin to feel... My teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say that he could get into deep samadhi in just a few minutes. And takes beginners months or weeks anyway, weeks and sometimes months, before they have a really deep samadhi experience. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and you feel that you're deeply in something. It's like being in something. And you feel your hands and face disappear maybe and so on. And my teacher used to say that he could sit down on the cushion and he would feel like he was a stick of incense. And he could feel the top of his head and the incense. He would imagine his body as a stick of incense and he could feel it burning down. And as it went down, he would just disappear. And he said after the stick was burned to the bottom, he was gone. He felt like he was just empty and open and spacious in all directions. And he wasn't boasting. I think he was just telling the truth. He could get into this extraordinary state of openness in a very rapid amount of time, like a couple minutes, he said. So it's possible to become to form an image of meditation as you sit down on the cushion, watch the breath, and you're supposed to go through these stages and have these experiences on the cushion. And it might work out that way. Sometimes it does. You sit down on the cushion, you watch the breath, your mind becomes blank. You begin to feel like your hands and face are disappearing, and so on and so on. But sometimes it's not like that at all, and you can begin to feel that your practice, you know, this is just not working for me. This is just not, I'm just not doing this right. You know, when I sit down on the practice, my mind is all over the place, and I'm unable to focus, and I think of my children, I think of my job, you know, and then, you know, half an hour is over, and I uncross my legs, and then I sit down, I'm not having any of these wonderful experiences that you describe. It's possible to misunderstand that Zen is not always going to work in this ideal way, and that it's really not a problem. It's not a problem. When Buddhism started. Early Buddhists understood the Buddha's teaching in a certain way. So early Buddhism outlines regular stages on the way to enlightenment. And there's actually, even today in, say, a Theravada tradition and Vipassana tradition, people talk about these regular stages. So these are called, these stages are called jhana. And basically, the Buddha said, you sit down on the cushion, straighten your back, follow the breath, and if you continue to do this, you'll begin to go through these predictable stages. And there's like a hierarchy. And there's a first stage, these stages are called jhana, and you go through the first jhana, and then you go through the second jhana. And he says, in the first jhana, you stop being aware of your physical sensations so heavily, and you're beginning to appreciate the truth of the Buddha's teachings. You know, and second jhana, thinking stops. In the third jhana, your sense of physical existence disappears. In the fourth jhana, and so on. And there are these regular steps. And if you talk to somebody from a Theravada tradition, they'll say, well, which jhana do you get to? And somebody might only be able to get to the third jhana, and somebody's gotten to the fourth jhana, and so on. And That was sort of how early Buddhism understood meditation practice, as like a system or a methodical system. And early Buddhism understood the Buddhist teachings as saying not only was there this methodical system, but actually if you meditate and you get through all the jhanas, when you have your enlightenment experience, you see things as they really are. As they really are. It's like you cut through all this illusion and you finally get to the truth. You finally get to a truth. And in one of the Buddha's, one of the early Pali Sutras, the Buddha said, when you have had enlightenment, you see everything just as it really is. He said, and the Buddha himself said, it's like looking into a pond where the water has grown clear and you can see the fish and the stones at the bottom. You know, so ordinary consciousness is muddy and murky. And we sit down on the cushion and we go through the jhanas, see, step by step. And we cut away all of our defilements, and the water gets clearer and clearer. And finally we can see to the bottom, see to the bottom. And this was how early Buddhism understood practice and understood enlightenment. As Buddhism developed, this version of practice, this understanding of practice, and this understanding of enlightenment began to be questioned, you know. One of the people who really started a revolution, the revolution that led to Zen, was a person named Nagarjuna, whose name we recite when we do our Dharma lineage, Nagarjuna, Dai Osho, great priest, Nagarjuna. And my feeling about Nagarjuna is that he was a very, very brilliant meditation practitioner. And Nagarjuna noticed something that maybe people hadn't paid so much attention to. You know, sometimes when you meditate, you're watching your breath, and you're paying attention to your breath, and then all of a sudden, you know, your mind will become blank. Maybe you experience this as like the breath disappearing. Or you're focusing on your koan, and the koan just disappears from your mind, and maybe just for a split second, you're in this place which is really like no place. Maybe you haven't had this experience. But if you meditate long enough, you know, you begin to have these experiences where you notice that there's like these empty spaces between your moments of awareness, you know. This is really important for us in Zen. We call this mu, or u, emptiness. And I think that other practitioners had noticed this, but Nagarjuna really understood the significance of these experiences. You know, sometimes people's minds go blank, you know. You know, if you have to give a speech and you're very nervous, and you get up in front of the audience, your mind can go blank. When I was a little boy, when I was living in the state of Virginia, you had to recite the presidents in the fifth grade. And I remember I stood up to recite the presidents and my mind went completely blank. At the time, that just filled me with dread. But that blankness is really quite important in a Zen view. And Nagarjuna said, look, you know, you don't have to be in any particular jhana to experience that blankness. You know, it's no matter what kind of state of meditation you're in, you know, you can stumble into this blankness because it's always there. It's always there. Nagarjuna said, you know, the important thing is not to worry so much about where you are in your progress towards enlightenment. That in some ways, this experience of like emptiness or blankness is more important than worrying about getting to different stages of enlightenment. And the Nagarjuna said, you know, sometimes an absolute beginner can sit down on the cushion and just have this blank mind right away. And sometimes very advanced practitioners have a hard time finding this blankness, you know, especially if they're obsessed with reaching different stages and meditative attainments. Sometimes, if you're not even meditating, if you go out for a walk in the woods and you're just relaxed and you're listening to the wind, if you suddenly look at your mind, you may notice that your mind is actually naturally rather blank and rather empty. I think Nagarjuna really made a change in direction of meditation practice. And Zen, in many ways, is really really all about this. Is really building on this teaching of Nagarjuna. If you come to a Zen center, sometimes people will tell you how to breathe. And sometimes people will tell you how to sit. But, you know, you'll never hear people talk to you about the jhanas or the stages of practice. They'll just say, watch your breath. And, you know, there's a lot of confidence that if you sit on the cushion long enough, you're going to blunder into, sort of stumble into, this blankness, you know. It's really not so important whether your hands and face disappear or whether you feel like you're floating off the cushion. It's not even important. You know, last night a woman came up to me. She had been, she's been sitting for a while. And she said, I went into deep samadhi. She said, I had a deep samadhi experience. And I said, oh, wonderful. And she said, but the funny thing is, you know, I had it just as I was daydreaming. I wasn't trying to count my breath or anything. I was just daydreaming, and all of a sudden I had this deep samadhi experience. And, the early Buddhist understanding of meditation practice as this very methodical, very step-by-step practice is really very artificial. You know, if you turn your attention to the mind at almost any time, you know, you can stumble into this blankness. And it's right there, Nagarjuna said, all the time. So it's really important not to become too obsessed with achieving any particular state of mind on the cushion. This is very much an element of Zen practice that people don't always understand. But, in Zen, sometimes meditation is called minding the mind. We're just looking at the mind and the mind's processing. And if you watch the mind's processing, you're going to see all kinds of different things. You're going to see daydreams, you're going to see fantasies, you're going to see emotions, you're going to see memories, you're going to see pieces of thought. All of this stuff is going to be drifting by. And every once in a while, you'll notice that there are these little spaces, these little empty spaces. And if you do Zen, you know, I'll ask you to try to pay attention to those. But it's not so important, really, to control the mind or to make sure your mind's in any particular place. What you really want to do is just see the mind moving, and notice maybe these moments of blankness that seem to be that arise sometimes unexpectedly, if you just watch the mind. There's another aspect to this sort of unsystematic nature of Zen practice. And it also goes back to the differences between, say, early Buddhism and later Buddhism. You know, the Buddha said after enlightenment, you can see things as they really are. It's like looking in a pond and seeing the fish and the stones at the bottom of the pond. Early Buddhism understood this as meaning when you get rid of all the obstructions and the mind is perfectly disciplined, you will be able to see things as they are. And early Buddhism actually believed that there were basic components of reality, like the building blocks of reality. They were little packages. It's kind of hard to describe, but little packages of space-time. I'm not kidding. This is what they said. Little packages of space-time, and they called these dharmas. This is not the same as the Dharma. But these little they felt that reality could be, if you really watch, you'll see that reality is like these little instances, in little moments of awareness. Just like very, like a flash. So you hear a sound, it's just a moment of awareness. And then you might see the carpet, there's a moment of awareness. And that actually these awareness can be broken down into these little tiny moments that are almost like strings in string theory. This sounds like science fiction, but this is what they really believed. There were these permanent entities called dharmas. So, the idea is if you sit down on the cushion and you discipline your mind and you eliminate all obstructions, you will see the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. You'll see it with your own eyes. Maybe you'll glimpse a dharma as it's slipping by. I was reading a Theravada monk, and he said there's something like 1,000 dharmas in each minute, or something like that. And I just thought, I wonder if you've noted, I wonder if you've seen them yourself, or at any rate, we in Zen don't really believe in dharmas. We don't think they exist. The Zen view is quite different from that. The Zen view is like this. I imagine that most of you have seen the movie The Matrix. This movie was so famous. If you're one of the only Americans who hasn't seen the movie, I won't go through the whole plot, but it's about a computer programmer, basically, who's living in a world that he thinks is real. And then this mysterious being comes to him and says, this world is not real. This world is not real. It's a projection, or it's a synthetically created fantasy that you're living in. And he says, the hero's name is Neo. He says, Neo, I will give you a pill. You can take the blue pill, will restore your take you back to your life as you know it in the illusion. And if you eat the other pill, you will go through the illusion and see the reality behind it. So of course our hero takes the pill that liberates him from illusion, and then he's in reality. Okay, so this is an early Buddhist understanding of things, actually, that we live in a kind of fantasy world that's created by our illusion and our obstruction. And then we take the pill of Buddhism, and we see things as they really are, and after we have had all of our obstructions cleared away. Now, that's not the Mahayana view. This is probably a little surprising, because a lot of people who think this is what Buddhism is all about don't understand maybe where Zen is coming from. The Zen view is, look, Morpheus says to Neo, Neo, you can take the red pill and stay where you are. You can take the blue pill and go to reality. So Neo takes the blue pill and he wakes up in the submarine or whatever it is. But little by little, Neo would begin to realize that this too was a dream. So then he takes another pill, see, and he's in another place. But this too is a dream world, see. So actually, the Mahayana view, the Zen view, is you take a pill to get out of your dream world and you just wind up in another dream world. And then you take a pill and you wind up in another dream world. So the thing is, you know, all worlds that we live in are actually mental constructs. All worlds that we live in are mental constructs. This is actually, in the Mahayana teaching, the Buddha is supposed to have said this to his arhats, to his early, to his original followers. And when they heard this, they had heart attacks. That didn't really happen, but it was such a radical teaching. But the Mahayana view is that if you get out of this this thought world, you just wind up in another thought world. And if you get out of that thought world, you just wind up in another thought world. And in a way, there's no escape from these thought worlds, see. Now, this doesn't sound like Buddhism, I know. Most people sort of have that early Buddhist view. We sit on the cushion, we have enlightenment experience, we see things as they really are, but later Buddhists said that's just not how it works, you know. Every time we open the world up, we create a kind of a thought world. We create this artificial thought world. You know, this is not so crazy if you think about it. You know, I was reading something the other day, and it was about animals' worlds, worlds of animals. And this biologist was saying, actually, different species live in different worlds, he said, different mental worlds. And he said, he called them it has to be a fancy word, Umwelt. Has the Umwelt. He said every animal has its own Umwelt. So he said, for example, spiders and flies don't live in the same world. A spider lives in his own mental world that reflects his own, his eye structure, his senses, his tactile the nervous system that makes him such a tactile being. And the spider lives in a spider world, a spider's mental world. And the fly lives in a totally different world. He has a different kind of eyes. His experience of the world is totally different. And he said the Umwelt of the spider and the Umwelt of the fly don't match up. That actually flies fly into spider webs, and they never even know how they got, they don't even know what is holding them because they can't figure it out. They live in different mental worlds. You know, this is actually, you can see this with something like, birds hitting glass windows. Birds will never figure out glass windows. We invented glass windows, but the bird Umwelt can't make sense of glass windows. So, a spider lives in a spider universe, and a fly lives in a fly universe, and birds live in a bird universe, or different birds probably live in different universes. Just the other day, they discovered that hummingbirds and insects have a different, very different experience of time from human beings. So they said even a fly processes information much faster than we do. So, you know, this is why it's so hard to catch a fly. Have you ever tried to catch a fly? It's so hard to do because their nervous systems process information so much faster than ours. So we're not all living in the same time. We're not all living in the same time. Experientially, you know, for the fly, we sound like this. Right? They think, oh, what cumbersome, slow creatures those humans are, right? We move at a glacial speed, right? Isn't that interesting? You've probably felt this yourself. When you go to your job, if you have a high-pressure job, you're in your job, and there's just a pressure. Everything has to be done yesterday, you know, and you're working very hard, and you're dashing around. You think, did I have lunch? I didn't even have time for lunch, right? And it all seems totally real It's like the universe of your, the job, the mental world of your job seems totally real, totally real. And it seems totally all-encompassing. The whole universe becomes your job, the job universe, right? And absolutely, this seems totally real. You know, if you come in and you, at the end of the day, you realize, oh my God, I didn't answer that email. Oh my God, and your heart is racing. You get down, you open the email, you write, you know, pardon me, I didn't mean, you know, this is very important, I understand, you know. Maybe you go to sleep at night and you think, why did I take so long to answer that email? Okay. Then you go on vacation, right? You go to, the British Virgin Islands. You're sitting on the beach. And you're, you know, time has a totally different character, right? Totally different character. And you're sitting on the beach and it just now... The moments are so different, right? There isn't a sense of temporal compression, right? That's gone. Time seems to open up in all directions. It's like, when will we eat? Well, we can eat now, we can eat in an hour. You know, let's just listen to the sound of the waves. And, you know, then you think, emails, who cares, you know? I mean, if you can get away with it, right? You think, I'm not going to answer my emails, you know? They can stuff it, you know? And you realize that world was so artificial. That world was so artificial, you know? This is reality, right? This is reality. The beach, the waves, the sky. You know, when you're back in your office, you think, that was a fantasy world. This is reality. You know, the deadlines, you know? So, the Mahayana view is there's no escaping this fact. That no matter where you are, you're going to be in like this all-encompassing thought universe, thought world. And that humans just do, all sentient beings do this, flies, you know, we're all living in this artificial universe. And you take the pill and you close your eyes and you're no longer in the office building, you're now on the submarine with Morpheus, but that too is a dream. And then you take the pill again and that too is a dream. You know, so this could be like, you could say, oh my God, that's a hellish world, right? That's a hellish situation. So there's no exit. There's no exit. There's no way out. See, and sometimes we want a way out. You know, we want to cut through the illusion. You know, I don't know if you are addicted to politics as I am, but you know, I've been reading a lot about the government shutdown and I think to myself, this can't really. I was saying to a friend of mine, you know, when I was 25 years old. You know, the Environmental Protection Agency had just been passed. Environmentalism was becoming a big deal. Civil rights had triumphed, you know. It looked like a beautiful, you know, who would have guessed 35 years later, you know, we would be in this madhouse, right? Where it looks like the Confederacy is trying to take over the United States and, it's just like a nightmare. And I find myself saying sometimes, get me out of here, right? Get me out. In the Matrix, you know, when Neo is being pursued, he gets on his radio or whatever it is, and he says, show me a door. Okay, you know, go to the right. You know, I just wish I could get away from John Boehner and all these people, you know, and just go through that door, and then I'd be on the beach, right? So I actually think this is a very sophisticated understanding of what the life of the mind is really like. See, I think that early Buddhists did not understand the mind very well. Later Buddhism understands the mind much better, in my opinion. This is, of course, a biased opinion. But this idea that every time, that no matter where you are, you're creating a kind of thought construct. It's actually called a thought construct, right? And it's sustained by what the sutras call energy habits, right? So, you know, this is not so crazy, right? You know, if you go to work, you know, you can feel the adrenaline pumping. You know, the more you go to work and you go through this process, the more real it all becomes, right? If you repeat something, you create what the sutras call these energy habits. Energy habits. These are like habitual patterns of behavior and emotion, right? And they become, the more you repeat something, the more real it becomes. Another way to think about it is your brain is rewiring itself all the time, you know? You sort of create your brain, you create your conscious world, and the more you repeat, the more compelling and persuasive an illusion it becomes. So it's possible to say, you know, you might be thinking, oh my God, is this really what Zen is about? You know, so there's no escape. There's no escape. You go from this illusory world to this illusory world to this illusory. And yes, that is what Zen is about. So it's like this, you know, what do you do? How are you going to deal with things if that's really how it is? That you take the blue pill and you wind up on the submarine, but that's an illusion, and then you take the blue pill again and you wind up somewhere else. You know, now we'll put aside Matrix, and we'll go to Groundhog Day, right? The other great Buddhist movie. Because that's where, that picks up where Matrix leaves off, right? See, there's no escape. So, you know, you're going to live, so to speak, your life again and again and again in some thought world. What are you going to do? Since you can never cut through the illusion and be at the truth, you can never cut through the illusion and be at the truth, right? Or the Mahayana view is a little different from that. That would be a Theravada view, a Hinayana view. The Mahayana view is, okay, they're all true. They're all true. There's infinite numbers of thought worlds, as it says in the sutras, there are infinite numbers of thought worlds just as there are infinite numbers of grains of sand in the Ganges. So every possible thought world you could create and imagine probably exists. So now what do you do? See, since you can't escape from thought worlds, what do you do? And the Mahayana view is, look, they're all real. So the question is, how do I inhabit this moment? I can be angry, fearful, I can be competitive, I can be envious, you know, or I can sit down on the cushion and I can watch my breath, and I can go into Mushin once in a while, and I notice I'm calmer, I feel compassion, you know, and so no matter where you are, you know, you're there, and you have to just cope. You have to cope. And cope means, what does cope mean? In Mahayana view is, cope means becoming one with. Becoming one with. So in a way, the Mahayana view is, become one with the thought world, whatever it is. Become one with what's happening. Become one with what's happening. And, you know, in other words, when the boundary between yourself and the world goes away, compassion arises. Compassion arises. And so the real problem is not getting to the truth. It's eliminating the sense of separation. Basically in the movie Groundhog Day, you know, he wants a certain outcome in life. He wants a certain kind of event to happen in his life, you know? And it doesn't happen. And so all these things that are happening to him, he looks at with contempt, with anger, right? You've probably seen the movie. And, you know, he becomes so unhappy about the world he's living in. He commits suicide. He, becomes a motorcycle guy, he becomes a womanizer, he becomes a drug dealer or something, I don't know. But finally he realizes, whatever is happening, I have to be with what is happening, like 100%. Whatever is happening, I have to be with what is happening 100%. At the most elemental level, Zen is about being here now to the fullest extent of our abilities, right? So, we're watching the breath not really to become more advanced meditators. We're watching the breath in order to become one with the breath. If you become one with the breath, many lovely things happen because the boundary between yourself and the world drops away. So the orientation of early Buddhism was that we live in a world of samsara, we live in a world of illusion and suffering, and what we have to do is detach, get free from. And there's a whole system for doing this, and there's forms of consciousness that are undesirable and forms of consciousness that are desirable, and there's a hierarchy. So some forms of consciousness are very undesirable and other forms of consciousness are very desirable. And it's all quite methodically laid out. The Mahayana view is all forms of consciousness are dharma doors. See, this phrase dharma door is very important. In other words, any form of consciousness can lead to enlightenment. Any form of consciousness. Boredom, lust, even envy, if you become one with it, transforms itself into something quite wonderful. Transforms itself into generosity. It's amazing, right? Outside of Chinese temples and Japanese temples, there are usually these very fierce guardian figures. They're warrior figures. So, Buddhism, everybody knows Buddhism is in favor of peace, right? Buddhism is, Buddha taught nonviolence and so on. So everybody understands Buddhism is about peace. So if you go to a temple, especially older temples, right outside the door are these incredibly frightening, fearsome warrior figures. And you can say, what are these doing at this place of peace? See, this is very Mahayana view. And what it's saying is that even these wrathful energies, these destructive forces, can be transmuted into something very positive. And the magic key, the magic elixir, is not to fight against, but to become one with. When you become one with your lust, it turns into love. When you become one with your envy, it can turn into admiration or compassion. When you become one with your sense of disappointment, that will become compassion. When you become one with your sense of confusion, that will become compassion. One way to think about meditation is that you're going to become superhuman. And actually, this again, early Buddhism, the arhat was thought to be like a dharma superman. Really, this is the early Buddhist literature. The arhat was, they didn't have a concept of the bodhisattva, they had this idea of the arhat. And the arhat had gone totally beyond all human desires and so on, and all human needs, and was like this superman. But, the Mahayana ideal is not like that, at all. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, you might see a big fat Buddha figure, right? Outside, as you go in the restaurant, there's a big Buddha with a big belly and so on, and he's smiling. And, that's not necessarily an appealing image of Buddhism. But actually, there's a deep truth in that, the idea of somebody who is not trying to be a superman, the original form of that sculpture is just a monk, and he's got on sort of an old robe, and his belly is hanging out because he has a big belly, And he's, everywhere he goes, he's at home and at ease, and he's embracing everything and everyone he meets without discrimination. And he doesn't, he becomes one with whatever he encounters. See? And so he's not trying to be a Dharma Superman. He's not trying to be Arnold Schwarzenegger or Brad Pitt. You know, he has a big belly. But he's, and he doesn't have a beautiful robe, and it isn't properly tied, and so on. He doesn't have brocade. You know, he's become one with the world in all of its vulgar, silly, misguided, crazy, self-destructive qualities, right? No. So this is the Mahayana view. This is the Zen view, you know. It's not a question of getting out of this moment and into the right moment, some other moment. It's being one with this moment, whatever it is. And there isn't going to be a better moment in the future. It's just another thought world sustained by energy habits. See, and in fact, you know, if you read the great sutras of Zen, if you want to read, do further reading, as they say, is read the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is not the most complete teaching of Zen. The most complete teaching of Zen is called the Lankavatara Sutra, the Descent into Lanka Sutra, which is the sutra that Bodhidharma brought from India to China. It's the only book he brought. And that was basically, Zen is Lankavatara Buddhism, basically. But both of them say the same thing. You know, if you really want to understand reality, understand that it's like a dream. This world is like a dream. And when you wake up from this dream, you're just going to be in another dream. And you wake up from that dream, and you're just going to be in another dream. The point is, if that's your situation, what do you do? And the solution is, become one with. Okay, I am in a dream. What am I going to do with my dream? Am I going to be helpful, kind, loving, patient, or angry, aggressive, and so on? So, the choice is yours. Right? You have free choice. But probably if you pursue that option of becoming one, your life just gets deeper and deeper, better and better. And when the boundary between ourselves and the world drops away, which is what happens sometimes on the cushion, just by watching the breath, you feel so alive. You feel so so happy and joyous. Just think, there's all of this in these, like, 30 words. A monk asked Nansen, "Is there any Dharma that has not been preached to the people?" Nansen answered, "There is." "What is the truth that has not been taught?" asked the monk. Nansen said, "It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things." Mumon's comment, at this question, Nansen used up all his treasure and was not a little confused. Mumon's verse, "Talking too much spoils your virtue. Silence is truly unequaled. Let the mountains become the sea. I'll give you no comment."